Welcome to Florida.
That is the voice of New York Times bestselling author and award-winning environmental reporter, Craig Tipton. My name is Chad Scott, and even though Craig is stumping for a new job, I don't think there's much chance I'm going to lose him here on the podcast.
Oh, darn.
Your latest Florida Phoenix column, check it out, floridaphoenix.com, or links to it on Craig's Twitter account, at Craig Times. You want to help the Department of Environmental Protection and become the director?
Well, I wrote a letter to the governor, an open letter to the governor, saying, hey, I know you've been busy battling, you know, big tech and the casino, the cruise ship people. Mm-hmm. But, you know, take a minute. Here's a big chance for you. The head of the DEP has resigned in the middle of a toxic algae bloom crisis. You promised in 2018 to stop these toxic algae blooms. Obviously, that hasn't worked. So you need to put me in charge of the DEP, and yeah, I'll take care of it for you. And I explained all the stuff I would do to fix it. And, gee, you really think I don't have a chance? I'm shocked to hear that.
I don't. Obviously, your tongue was planted firmly in cheek for that column. But you did talk to a number of conservation leaders around the state, because the Florida Department of Environmental Prostitution, as I like to call it, does nothing to actually protect the environment the way it's set up. What are the overarching criticisms of this organization?
Well, I mean, and the point I make in the column is there are still good people at the DEP, but there are so many impediments to them doing their jobs and doing them correctly that they just can't, because the department over the last 20 years has been in this slide from being a regulator and a protector of the environment to being an enabler of polluters. And a lot of big steps along that way were taken during the Rick Scott administration, but it started even before that, even all the way back in the Lawton Childs administration. And I pointed out some of the stops along the way, like, for instance, when the head of the DEP under Jeb Bush arranged a shaky loan to International Paper so they could continue polluting Perdido Bay in Pensacola, and then he got a job with International Paper. Uh-huh. Coincidence, that kind of thing. So, but the overarching complaint is that they are very, very cozy with industry, and that there's actually testimony at one public hearing where one of the regulators said, well, we're supposed to be working in the public interest. We view this polluter's business as being in the public interest. Therefore, we were willing to do whatever they wanted us to do. That's not serving the public. That's serving somebody who's making a profit off of turning our bays and rivers and lakes and springs into toilets. Mm-hmm. And I just think maybe the next head of the DEP maybe could try to reverse that. So that was the point I was trying to make.
How likely do you think that is to occur?
I'm guessing it's about as likely as me getting the job running the DEP. So you might want to call up the Seminole Tribe and place a bet on that, or you may not.
Yeah. Well, this week's guest is going to tell us about a great Florida author. And we've had great Florida authors on this show. It's co-hosted by a great Florida author. Of course, we've talked to Carl Hiaasen. We've had episodes recently on Marjorie Kinnon Rawlings. And
Zora Neale Hurston. Yeah.
Zora Neale Hurston. Yeah. This week's guest is going to talk about someone who was new to me, but very familiar to you. Set the table here. Who is John D. McDonald?
John D. McDonald was a writer who lived in Sarasota for about 30, 40 years and wrote an awful lot of books. I want to say close to 70 books. I mean, the guy was he was cranking them out. But he wrote some that are really well known. He wrote one book that became the basis for the movie Cape Fear. He's probably best known for his books about Travis McGee, who is sort of this tarnished knight errant, as he described him, mm-hmm. who lived on a houseboat in Fort Lauderdale and called himself a salvage expert. So people would come to him when they were desperate to get something back that they had lost. And inevitably that would lead to, you know, murder and shady developers and, you know, that kind of stuff. And he was also an environmental activist before people even really kind of knew the term. And he would slip those messages about the environment, about mm-hmm. the importance of Florida's natural beauty into his books. And an awful lot of people that I know who are natives like me grew up reading his books. One friend of mine says that it became sort of an intergenerational tie for her and her father and her grandfather. They disagreed on a lot of stuff, but they all agreed that on Johnny McDonald, Travis McGee, and rapscallions, as she put it.
Calvin Branch is our guest. He is a biographer and historian about John D. McDonald. You can find him online, JDM homepage. DEEP.org. And without further ado, let's get to it.
Calvin, what first attracted you to John D. McDonald's books? What was the first one you ever read?
The very first one was probably Clemmy. I say that because we're talking a long time ago, 1965.
Wow.
And I was a first-year teacher at Killingly Junior High School in Danielson, Connecticut. And as you know, of course, educators and teachers are always paid an enormous amount of money. In my first year of teaching, I made $3,750, and you got paid once a month. And usually what would happen is that every Friday afternoon, if I could put together a dollar or two, I would go down to a little bookstore across the railroad tracks, and there were all sorts of paperbacks. And that's where I came across McDonald. And that's when I first started reading McDonald's, continued buying books over the next several years. But by the time 1980 rolled around, I had everything pretty much that he had written, and most of the novels of the 50s. And by 1982, I had all of his books, period.
So what was it that captured your imagination and made you
such a big fan? That's the thing I'm coming to now. I have been an avid reader since I was like 12 or 13 years old. And on weekends, as a teacher, I couldn't afford to go anywhere, but I could read books. And one weekend, I read 7 books, starting on Friday afternoon and ending late Sunday night. And the McDonald books were particularly good. The pace was very good. The characters are interesting. The settings I knew a little bit about, because many of those early books he set in New York State, which is where he grew up for the most part from age 10 on. So there was already a connection as far as I was concerned. His ability to plot. And of course, now I've learned so much more about him. In fact, at one point, I was trying to do an oral history of McDonald's in terms of people who knew him. So Victor Nunez, have you ever heard of A Flash of Green?
Yes. Great movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And well, Victor Nunez directed that. And I had I interviewed him up in his office up in Tallahassee. It was just fascinating because he really understood McDonald. In the opening scenes, it shows a guy sitting at his desk looking out over the water. And what goes by is just a father and his son holding a boat and they're fishing, just very slowly in the background. But that's precisely what the kind of thing that McDonald could do. He could evoke a real sense of place when he was doing his writing. Flash of Green is really one of my favorite books. And I used to show that film in my classes. If the staff had ever really known I was doing that, there were a couple of sex scenes, which you're not supposed to do, of course. But I never found a kid saying anything. They didn't want to see it, Mr. Branch. So therefore,
we won't tell on you.
A Flash of Green has actually came up in a couple of recent episodes, one about Florida movies. What about that particular book interests you and speaks to you so deeply?
The first thing primarily is the theme. And that is, as when we talk about the environment with McDonald, he had already been personally in Sarasota and Siesta Key, where he lived. He was already fighting a losing battle against a lot of the things, trying to fill in the bay and places so they could build more condominiums, et cetera. He fought long and hard, a lot of letters to the editor, and that fight that led him to writing that book, and it has to do with Save Our Bay. What he did was create a character, Jimmy Wing, and Jimmy Wing is a newspaper person, a reporter, and he sells his soul to Elmo Bliss, who is one of a kind of a crooked person in the city council. And they've got a deal in the background to fill in the bay and build condominiums, et cetera, et cetera. That was the kind of thing that I really enjoyed. In fact, one of those things that happens in real life, between 2000 and 2018, I was on the Pasco County Planning Commission. Huh. And nearly every time when something came in, when developers were going to say, we're building 1,000 homes here, 1,500 homes there, and so forth, I would feel this gentle tap on my shoulder. It was Johnny McDonald saying, watch it. Try hard not to let them do that if you can. And occasionally, I was successful. But, Rachel Carson, we're obviously talking about her contributions, but McDonald was the first Florida fiction writer to emphasize the environment and what was happening. If I reach over here, there's just one quick thing I want to read to you before we go too much further, if I may. The Dreadful Lemon Sky. It was easy to see the shape and history of Bayside, Florida. There had been a little town on the bay shore, a few hundred people, a sleepy downtown with live oaks and Spanish moss. Then International Amalgamated Development had moved in, bought a couple thousand acres and put in shopping centers, townhouses, condominiums, and rental apartments just south of town. Next had arrived Consolidated Construction Enterprises and had done the same thing north of town. Smaller operators had done the same thing on a smaller scale west of town. And when downtown decayed, the town fathers said, well, what can we do? So they widened the streets and cut down the shade trees in an attempt to look just like a shopping center. It didn't work. It never does. This was instant Florida, tacky and stifling and full of ugly and spurious energies. They had every chain food service outfit known to man interspersed with used car lots and furniture stores. It's on page 49 of Dreadful Lemon Sky. You know, probably could take all the things he said about the environment and so forth and the impact of builders. And that was one of them. And I don't know, Craig, if you know this for or not, but as a result of his book in 1977 called Condominium, which was about deceitful building practices over there on the East Coast and Miami and that area, Fort Lauderdale. And in that book, have you read The Condominium, by the way?
Oh, good Lord, yes. And sing its praises frequently. I keep telling people that's so, even though it's not a Travis McGee book, it's his masterpiece.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's because of that book, though, we know that building codes in South Florida were actually changed, partly because a good deal because of that particular book. Wow. So I always thought that was a rather good thing for a person to have done.
Well, let's go back to Flash of Green for just a minute. That came out in 1962.
Yep.
The same year as Silent Spring from Rachel Carson.
Yeah,
so it's
right.
My understanding is it's the first environmental novel in the nation, not just from Florida.
Oh yeah. Yeah, it probably is. I would hesitate. I don't know for sure, but I would expect it's quite possible that it was. And over the years, there were a lot of articles he wrote in various newspapers in terms of Florida and the impacted environment. So on Flash of Green, you have the character Jimmy Wing, who in fact sells his soul to Elmore Bliss and does these things on the side by keeping Bliss aware of what the Save Our Bay people were doing to try to stop the development. And at some point, he begins to understand that what he's just done is wrong. And now the rest of the novel is a man's attempt to salvage his dignity in some way. And I don't want to destroy the novel for people who have not.
Yeah, don't give it away. Don't give away the ending.
But
what drove him to include those for the time very unusual messages in his fiction to you know sort of slip in these environmental arguments inside the package of a thriller?
Yeah, one of the things about McDonald is this: he was known for his prescience. He was the one. He was a terrific reader, and if you looked in his personal library, you'd see a lot of the things that he dealt with ended up in his books. He was seeing early before other people what development was doing to Florida. And as a result, he wanted to include those things in his books, and he did. One of the things I used to say when I was giving lectures on McDonald's several years ago was that a lot of authors started to do the same thing in their writing. And you could tell the difference between an author who really knew what he was trying to do and someone who just said, well, I better do this because Johnny McDonald did. So I better throw in something here, you know, like some shopping center make bad thing or something like that. But you could always tell. The author who really knew what he was trying to do. You take James Hall or Randy Wayne White, two major examples of good Florida writers, and who acknowledged their debt to McDonald when they first started out. And both of them, in their novels, have written a great deal about the environment. And that's why A Flash of Green was always important to me.
So how did he develop Travis McGee? Travis McGee, of course, his most famous creation, this fictional boat bum / salvage expert who... is catnip to women and a magnet for trouble.
His publisher for years had been begging him to write a series character, and he didn't want to do that. But around 1962, he gave in. There were three books that he wrote before he published the first one, which was Deep Blue Goodbye. But it's interesting to read the other two books because they were really potboilers in his mind. He had one where the character Travis McGee was a real smartass. He had a funny answer for everything and so forth. And the other Travis McGee in his other book was really tough, you know, right out of the hard-boiled school and so forth. And eventually he said, no, I don't want that. So he put them together and he came up with Travis McGee. Mm-hmm. So that's where we are. And of course, the name McGee, Travis comes from Travis Air Force Base. And he was originally going to call it Dallas McGee. But because of the unfortunate assassination and so forth, so they renamed it Travis and so forth.
I did not know.
I think it was McKinley Cantor who came up with that idea.
Oh, his friend from fellow writer from Sarasota,
yeah.
Right?
Right.
Yeah. And there were what, 27 of the McGee books?
21.
How did he get to the Sarasota area?
He was living in Mexico, wasn't he, originally?
Well, actually, when he came out of World War II, he'd always said, I thought writers were always born. You couldn't become one by studying. It so happened that in the World War II letters, which, as I put a plug in, my wife and I and another person, we put together all the World War II letters of Johnny and Dorothy McDonald's are going to be published for free by the Florida Press, the University Press.
Oh, when is that coming out?
Hopefully in another couple of months.
That's great.
What we went through is we went through every single letter and we typed them up and so forth. And I got to know McDonald probably more by reading all the letters between 1943 and 45 than I would have in any other possible way. He wrote near in late 1940, January 45, he actually sent a story to Dorothy back in Utica, New York. He just sent it to her and quite frankly, it wasn't all that good. But Dorothy thought it was very good, and she sent it off to one of the magazines who rejected it. But then Story Magazine bought it for $25. So in September of 1945, when McDonald gets off his boat coming back from the war, walks up, greets his wife and his son Maynard, at that time was about five, and says, "Oh, by the way, honey, you're a published author." Well, it didn't actually come out until about a year later. But anyway, he said, "Well, maybe I'll try to do that." So he started in October of 1945, living in 1109 State Street in Utica. He began to write. And when I say write, he wrote 7 days a week, 10 to 12 hours a day.
Oh, wow.
And he's a machine. Sell, the guy was
didn't
a machine.
Sell a thing. It was months before he sold his first story. And I think the first one was $5.
Wow.
Yes, granted, the $25 he got for that interlude in India. Yeah, that was out there, but that was already had been done beforehand. So he went through just what a lot of good writers do. It takes a long time to get settled, get known, and so forth. By 1947, though, he was getting fairly regularly published. In 1948, there were some of the slick magazines that had detective stories and mysteries and so forth. In many cases, and I've got some of them in my collection, you open up the book and there's 15 short stories. And every single one of them was by Johnny McDonald. He had created, pseudonyms and so forth. He would knock off, by the time he started doing novels in late 1949, 50, he could knock off a novel sometimes in like 4 days. As a matter of fact, one of the interesting things about him, he was always used to talk about, I'll say this, when Maynard was growing up and he and Dorothy lived in Sarasota, McDonald would get up from the breakfast table and go up and they would hear him sit down. He would light up a cigarette and all of a sudden, it stopped, take another brag. He wore out typewriters over about every 3 or 4 months. He had to buy a new typewriter.
Man.
And he said, "I don't even know how the words appear. I just type in my mind and it goes right through my fingers. I look down and I haven't even been aware. I've just written a page." He said that was how good he was.
Wow.
Quite something. I mean, I'm sure he could never do that.
No. Extraordinary.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. So when you look at his publishing history, by 1950, when he made his first, published his first novel, because his publishers were saying, yeah, it's time for you to do a novel now. Between then and 1955, he was pushing out sometimes 3 or 4 novels a year. When you read those books, I all call them the novels of the 50s, they had a particular type of thing. And I want to mention this, too, because for anybody who wants to know anything about McDonald, I've got 11 notebooks, 3-inch notebooks sitting over on the floor. So I'm looking through things, and there's one person who was most responsible for John McDonald and his success, and that was his father. His father was Eugene McDonald, born in 1888. 12 years later, he was the breadwinner for his family in Connecticut. The father was a ne'er-do-well, and so young Eugene was out delivering newspapers. He got a job turning off and on the gas lights, made such an impression on a lot of his customers. And several of them said, "Look, hey, we'll pay for you to go to West Point. You're really a terrific young person." He never went there, but what happened was that he saved enough money so that he could move his mother to Washington, D.C., where they lived with her brother, and they were there for 3 or 4 years. And McDonald, at that point, Eugene had several things. He worked for the government. He worked for things. And every time he got a job, he would take courses. How do you become a salesman? How do you do accounting? Mm-hmm. How do you do all this stuff? By the time he was 20 years old, he was being headhunted by a lot of places. Why? Because Eugene McDonald stood for that old-time person who dragged himself up in a Horatio Alger way, dragged him by the bootstraps, and he did a very good job. He was somebody you could count on for getting things done. And so by 1927, he was now the vice president and treasurer of Stephen Savage Arms in Utica. And young Johnny McDonald at that point was 10 years old, and where they lived. And it's interesting. Look at the house now. I've taken pictures of it. It looks very much the same as it did in 1926. And at one point during that time, John D. McDonald came down with an illness, and he was in bed for a year. So he read all the time. So yet again, you look at McDonald's background.
What was the illness? Oh,
I never can remember what the damn thing was. It's like scarlet fever, that type of thing. You know, he was bedridden and so forth. His mother read to him, and he read a lot. And that was a thing he did all his life. And one of my favorite pictures of McDonald is on the back of one of his books. And it simply shows him stretched out on the couch, smoking a cigarette and reading a book.
How did he get to Florida? What attracted him to Florida?
Okay, well, he got to Florida because of two things. Number one, Dorothy was not all that well most of the time. She cold weather really bothered her. When McDonald got through college and the MBA, he got an MBA at Harvard. So we're not talking about 1938, 39. And so he's got jobs in central New York above Syracuse and up in Messina, New York. Well, I come from northern New York, and I know what it's like to be cold. In my area, we get 45 below zero, and that was normal. And it affected Dorothy a great deal. So at some point, they did go to Mexico one winter. But then they decided the following 1950 to come to Florida. And they ended up right in Clearwater, and they had a small house they rented. They went back up north and then came back down the following year to Sarasota, where they lived for Point Crisp. From 1956 to 1968, when his new home that he was building that was hurricane proof, 19 30-foot pine logs buried into the limestone. That house was not going to blow away at any time. And then he was, again, always one of those planners. I won't do it today, but I've got a 3-page essay he wrote on what I want in my house, how it's going to be. He valued his privacy because he wrote all the time. So the brand new house that he had only had one bedroom. And when Maynard would come from New Zealand, he and his wife moved there in 1967, and the family would come to visit once a year. And what McDonald did was he bought a condominium down the road, and that's where the family would stay and, of course, visit with him in the house. But he didn't have any extra room for anybody. The only room they had upstairs was simply for storage and so forth. And when he died in 1986, and his wife, Dorothy, died in 1989, Maynard had a yard sale. And there were people went upstairs, and they were looking in that room, and they found old-fashioned bags, sacks, with the cuttings. Craig, you might remember this. The cuttings from the bottom of suit, of pants. Remember, you could go and get the pants?
Oh, yeah.
And the cuttings. He saved all those cuttings, so in case they had to mend a pair of pants.
Wow.
It's a different world that we live in, you know?
Yeah, no kidding. And now he worked like in an apartment above the garage or something, didn't he?
In Point Crisp, yes. It was just above the garage. And Dorothy had her studio below that where she did artwork and so forth. And then when they moved to Siesta Key, they had a very large living room area right off that large living room area. In fact, the only picture I've got of him in his study is in my website, and it shows him. You know, he's got two or three computers and all sorts of books and so forth. That was his place, and all his research and so forth was done there.
Let me throw one at both of you, and I'll actually hit Craig with this first. People may not be impressed by this idea of writing for 10 hours in a row. The three of us are writers. It is incredibly taxing mentally and physically. It is like doing hard labor of the mind for 10 hours straight. Craig, how long can you write in a row, Craig? Sit down and just bang out hard.
Maybe an hour and a half, and then I got to get...
Yeah.
And look what we found out about Hemingway in that series that was on a couple months ago.
Stretch my legs.
One period of time a day, you know, when he wasn't drinking, and he would write for about 4 hours a day. Yeah. But McDonald was, well, okay, this is what I want to get back to then. This is why it was. I'm going to read to you something. When McDonald was 17 years old, his father said, okay, you had two choices. You can take another year of school, or I'm going to send you to Europe for a trip. And so he had a chaperone. And when he got on board ship, he opened up his suitcase, and there was this letter. Dear Jack, just a few lines to let you know how much pleasure it has given Mother and me to make your European trip possible, especially when we never had a similar opportunity. We feel that this trip will be a great experience and a great education for you. So naturally, we want you to make the most of it. Number one, Howell is to be the boss, not that we don't trust you, but rather because his age and experience will be helpful to you. Number two, make and keep as many friends as possible on the trip. Number three, Eat and function regularly, and if you do not feel well at any time, do not hesitate to secure medical attention. 4, I think you should write your mother from Paris, Rome, Venice, Amsterdam, and London as soon as you arrive, or at least once a week. Be sure to attend a religious service at least once each Sunday. 6, take as many interesting pictures as you can so that we can live the trip over again with you when you come back. And keep your nose clean and your tail up and don't stretch your hat. And above all, be courteous to all. The foregoing are not the Ten Commandments, but rather the sincere values of a fond and loving parents of a slow guy, Dad. Auf Wiedersehen. May your trip be all and more than you expected it to be. Now, Eugene MacDonald had he worked very hard all his life, and obviously he felt pretty good he could give his son a chance to do that. But I think what happened with MacDonald, when you look in the novels of the 50s, and you find lots of times there'll be somebody who's brought in to kind of take things over and put things right. And I really believe that that was MacDonald's father he was writing about in many of those novels.
It could be.
I've been telling you about EcoPathways, a Florida company that has developed an engineered material designed to replace the need for wood or pressurized lumber in dune walkovers, boardwalks, piers, docks, that sort of thing. So why do you want to replace wood or pressurized lumber? Well, wood, for one, does not hold up to Florida weather. The sun, the UV, the salt air, it begins to splinter and those nails start sticking up and it loses its coloring almost immediately. Pressurized lumber, on the other hand, does last longer, but it is full of toxic chemicals. Where do you think that pressurized treatment comes from? That is chemicals injected into the material that then leaches into the sand or the water, wherever you use that deck or boardwalk. Well, EcoPathways, eco-pathways.com has developed an engineered material that has no toxic chemicals that lasts far longer. This thing lasts, it has like a 75-year life to it, decades longer than wood or pressurized lumber. It holds its color. It is all modular so that it's easy to install. Learn more at eco-pathways.com. If you need a dune walkover, you live at the beach, you need a way to get from your deck to the water. If you need a boardwalk, if you're looking for a dock or a pier, eco-pathways.com to learn more.
Now, he was part of a whole group of writers in Sarasota that they called the Liars Club, wasn't he?
Yeah. McKinley Cantor, and I won't remember all of them now right now, but
I think John Jakes was a friend, I know.
Yep, John Jakes, and they met once a week on Friday afternoon, and among other things, they would, of course, talk about their respective writing, etc., and then they would play Liar's Poker. Have you done that yet?
Liar's Poker, is that the where you put it on your forehead? Or
yeah, you put a card in your forehead, and then you look around everybody else. Now, you're going to make a bet on what you think your card is for a good poker hand. Now, over the period of like 10 or 15 years that MacDonald was doing that, he came in about halfway up. He wasn't the worst. He wasn't the best. He was in the middle. And it was, of course, during that time in the Liars Club that McKinley Cantor used to look at MacDonald and says, you know, you ought to write yourself a good novel. You ought to do something there instead of all these little potboilers and things like that. And he bet him that he couldn't do it the next time around. Really?
He bet him?
Yeah, and the next time around, he wrote The Executioners, which of course became a movie with Gregory Peck and Polly Bergen and so forth. That's how he responded to that one.
Are there any traces of him still in the Sarasota area, a house, a foundation, a historical mark or anything like that?
Well, there's one called the John D. MacDonald Island. It's actually a little island. You couldn't see the sign that says it. But one of my dear friends, Karen Turbo, who she and I have been involved in the MacDonald stuff for 1,000 years, Karen was instrumental in two things. Number one, having that island named for him. It's in the area right there in Sarasota. Mm-hmm. And she also is responsible for getting MacDonald listed in the Florida Hall of Fame. She's the kind of person where if you say, will you do this, it's going to get done. If she has to take somebody out back and shoot them, it's going to get done. And it's been kind of interesting. But it's one of those things now. One of the best things I had happen was in 2016, we had a 100-year anniversary of MacDonald, my birthday. We had it in Sarasota. My wife and I did several programs for various libraries through the year. But then in July, we had a big get-together. We had all sorts of people there. One of the really cool things that day was seeing the people who really just loved anything that had to do with MacDonald and his writing. And I was very, very, very impressed with that. I'm just
they unveiled a pack. They unveiled a plaque that day. I was there, and so was Tim Dorsey.
Unveiled a plaque and so forth. And we had, in fact, that was during that time we gave Tim Dorsey the latest John D. Award for excellence in Florida writing.
And then they showed a flash of green. And they were able to do that because John Jakes wrote a big check to cover the exhibition cost.
Yeah. It was nice of him to do that because, and the first time he wrote that check to me, he put down the wrong number. And I had to call and say, another couple $100, John. But I managed it because I had interviewed Victor Nunez. I was after him for almost 2 years to say, I really like to, when we do the 2016 thing, I'd really like to show a flash of green. And what they had done was they had taken and remastered that film. And so the very first time that film was shown in public was that day in 2016. That
was a remastered
special
version.
Permission from the company that had done that. And of course, Victor helped a great deal in getting that permission, but that's how we got it. So I felt, again, very good that day when you've seen something through like that, that's always been meaningful to me. And I think meaningful to an awful lot of other people.
Well, I think a lot of people enjoyed seeing it too, because so many folks from Sarasota were extras in the film.
In fact, we had a lunch. I guess it was about 10 years ago. Somewhere on my wall, I've got a picture that of the two of the actors and Sam Gowan, who was the producer, and got together all things. We had a nice little meal down in Sarasota. It was a great time to get together with them, and just I was hearing it for the first time, of course, so I wasn't involved in it, but it was nice to hear them reminisce about how the movie went along. In fact, in my collection, I've got actually little snippets of film that was taken by somebody. It shows, Jimmy Wing.
It was Ed Harris.
Ed Harris. Jimmy Wing. I've got in this film a little thing about Ed Harris, just fooling around and so forth. But there's a scene, Craig, that you may remember, that it's early in the morning, and Ed Harris is sitting on the dock, and his feet is hanging down. He's just kind of low.
Yeah.
Well, the reason he was that way, because he'd been drinking till 4 o'clock in the morning and he had a hangover. And that's when I found out about that.
Why has there never been a successful Travis McGee movie? We were talking about Flash of Green turned into a great movie. The Executioners turned into two great movies, two versions of Cape Fear. Why? But Travis McGee's never been been made into a successful film.
He has been made. Darker Than Amber. And The Empty Copper Sea.
I wouldn't call those successful. Though. Yeah. No. Well, one of them, they moved to California.
Yeah.
That was part of the
problem. What it was there was an actor, one of the guys that won the movie, won the Academy Award for the Wall Street thing. Anyway, he was booked to do, they were going to do a Deep Blue Goodbye. They actually had built the Busted Flush.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was over in Puerto Rico, and it was all set to go. And then that actor suffered, in the movie he was in, he suffered an injury, and he couldn't move very well, and he would never be able to do the, I think in terms of the Flash of Green, I think in terms of a lot of the books he did, the Travis McGee series, certainly, the 21 novels. It's amazing the number of people who said, there's one called the Deep Black Goodbye or something, and that was the last one. Well, McDonald never wrote a last one.
Yeah,
and he just, people would say, when are you gonna do that and so forth. But I think McDonald went through a period a few times in his life where he wasn't very all that well. And in those last few years, between let's say 1981 and 1986, when he died, there were times when he really wasn't very well, and writing was a difficult chore for him, given the way he always did things, put himself down there in a chair and write. Mm-hmm. And he was having trouble, and his heart was giving him trouble, and so forth. And that's of course why he died. When we had a Johnny McDonald conference in 1990 in Fort Lauderdale, Maynard McDonald came in from New Zealand. And as these things happen, we had a big meal down in this big boat, and everybody was leaving. And I backed up my chair right into Maynard McDonald. So I turned around and apologized. And then we spent the next half hour talking about McDonald's last weeks alive. And it was really quite touching. Maynard and I have been in touch with each other, email and so forth, ever since, about 30 years now. And we trade things back and forth about his father, et cetera. Maynard, if he had ever decided to do something like write, I think he could have. So there are some times when if you look at my Johnny McDonald website, you'll see a thing called Legacy, which is what Maynard wrote to try to stem people saying, hey, is there going to be another McDonald after the Travis McGee? Is somebody kind of, you can allow some writer to come in. And he writes a very good thing as to why that cannot happen. And I was very pleased. And he wrote it in such a way that I can almost see. In fact, I said to Maynard, it sounds like your father talking.
I think it would be great, though, if they would do a Travis McGee movie or maybe a limited run cable series and just sort of recreate that. And I know they had that one guy who was injured, but I mean, surely yeah. that, you know, the property's there for someone else to step in and do it. And yeah, there's a built-in fan base, you know.
There have been attempts over the years many times, and Maynard has often kept me in touch with what was going on. The man who is the lawyer for the McDonald estate, he and I are in touch with each other frequently. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. I'd like to think it could be done, but it had to be done in such a way that it would not be cheesy.
Yeah.
Because at that point, it would ruin everything.
Well, I'm not sure you could make it in modern day Florida because everybody's got cell phones and that would sort of change, you know, it would change how things play out. But I mean, the themes are still timeless, you know, about greed over beauty and, you know, those kind of things.
Yeah, I want to read you something, if I may. It's a letter that John McDonald wrote to me. When I was teaching mystery fiction, I got the bright idea of writing to over 100 authors and just telling them, you know, could you answer some questions for me so that I can share these things with my mystery fiction class? So McDonald wrote this in May 1983. Dear Mr. Branch, press for time, but here is a quick shot at your three questions. Number one, the good themes to write about are always the big amorphous words, loyalty, greed, hope, love, hate, terror, faith, and so forth. And what one must do is to take an environment as specific as one can make it and characters as well-rounded and real as one can make them, and show them acting and reacting in the world of your story to incidents which develop their response to one or more of the themes listed above. And two, fiction, any genre, is far, far removed from reality. The young French novelists of the 60s experimented with trying to reproduce reality. For example, taking 60 full pages to describe a ship being docked. This was a short-lived stepchild of Sartre. Fiction is a series of code words which the reader must translate on the basis of his own life experience. The richer his life has been, and the more skilled the writer, the more effective will be the illusion of reality created. The skilled writer must trust the reader. He has to know that if he describes three items in a motel room vividly, the reader will create the rest of the room's furnishings out of his own fabrics. Mm-hmm. To take another aspect of the question, life itself is incredibly messy, misunderstood, random, terrifying, and often vile. The novelist has a terrible tendency to neaten it all up so that it makes some kind of sense. Matter of fact, if he didn't neaten it up, his novels would be unreadable. Literature is merely a temporary value judgment which changes from decade to decade. Literary giants of the past fade away to minor footnotes. Literary pygmies of the past, such as Dickens, Clemens, Dostoevsky, are pumped up like beasts in the Macy parade and then fade away again. Styles and fancies are in constant change, and there is no guarantee that anyone can ever give a valid definition of literary merit. All I know is that phrases like the world of literature tend to give me a rash. And that was one of the questions I asked about the world of literature. So you can imagine when I read that, Calvin's mind went, oh, no.
Okay, anyway. I'm tempted to jump in and defend Dickens as something more than a pygmy. Okay. But
here's the final thing of that.
Okay. Yeah.
I have been around quite a long time now, long enough to write over 70 books and publish over 500 short stories. And the very best writers I have met have been almost totally unconcerned with their place in the world of literature or their posthumous garlands. And conversely, the worst hacks have been awfully itchy or whether or not they will live for the ages, which of course they won't. Nobody will. Shakespeare, possibly. Think of it this way. Everybody in this business who is writing just as well as he can and who is aware of the passage of time and the shortness of the years has no time left to fret about the place of what he is writing in the world of literature. And that to me, and those two pages, I've done that all over the Florida and then the classes. I thought, I know, I couldn't have asked anything better to tell me why McDonald wrote and so forth. It's all right there.
Mm-hmm. Now, there were rumors that there was a last Travis McGee novel out there that had black in the title because he always put colors in the titles, and that somehow resolved what happened with McGee, and that perhaps he had an illegitimate child who showed up. Yeah. Is there any truth to that, or have you
no truth whatsoever? Maynard is very much aware of this, of course. He went through everything when his father was still alive. Mm-hmm. I mean, when McDonald's house was up a yard sale, I mean, people were going there to the house and opening up drawers, taking up pens, you know, buying things like that. It was incredible. But I have to tell you that in the Pasico Lake in the Adirondacks, which is where in 1944, Dorothy and John managed to get together about $300. And they bought an acre of land on Pasico Lake, which was very special to Dorothy and her family. By 1950, he was enough of a success so they could build a cottage. It was a 10-room cottage, each room 10 foot by 10 foot. And that's where they went easy every summer from 1950 to 1983. They went there every summer. When I was there, the guy who had bought this from Maynard, this was about 10, 12 years ago. When I was there, his name is Brad Dake, and he's a, like you, Craig, he's the head of the Adirondack Preservation Unit. He tries to make sure nothing's going to happen to Adirondacks, you know, like development and so forth. But he had already changed that house a bit. But there in the corner was McDonald's desk. And Calvin said, damn it, I've got a rental car. I can't get that desk in there. And I'm, you know, I got to go to Florida. How am I going to do this? So I kind of let it go. So about 5 years ago, I wrote Brad a letter. And I said, you know, I'll pay for it. Well, he had finally given up. He had simply thrown it away and burned it up.
Oh man.
I know. You know, just an ordinary, you can see the picture of it on my website. But you know, there's sometimes in life you say, I will tell you one other thing. And Craig, I know you've never had things you've regretted, but I have regretted it. And Chad, you look successful, so you probably haven't either. But in 1983, McDonald was given a lifetime award, the Grandmaster Award, by the Mystery Writers of America, and that was being done in New York City. So I grabbed my wife and I said, we got to go down there. That's all there is to it. So we went and we got in line on a day that on Saturday when McDonald was signing books. And I was the last one in line. And I said, gee, I teach two of your books in my English class. And he said, well, got to teach them English. And he went on to somebody else. But the next day, Walter Schein, whom I had met, said to me at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, he says, Cal, why don't you, Nola, come up? John and Dorothy are coming to our room for cocktails. Why don't you come join us? Now, you know what I'm going to say. Two teachers from Massachusetts said, we got to get home. We got to prepare for tomorrow.
Oh, no.
Oh, no. So I know you guys thought it'd be nice to interview me, but that tells you just how bad I am.
Calvin Branch has been our guest. You can find him online and more about John D. McDonald, jdmhomepage.org. Calvin hosts a podcast called Area of Suspicion. It is posted to that website. Craig has been a guest. Go ahead and check that out. Calvin, thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome.
Sharing your story.
Before you go,
indeed, my pleasure.
Before you go, one more question.
Yeah.
Is there still a plaque at the Bahia Mar for where the busted flush supposedly was?
Okay. What you have to do is you have to go back to the dock master's office. You open up the door and the plaque's right there.
Commemorating a non-existent boat owned by a fictional character.
Right. Well, it was, you know, for many years, it was right there. And I said, when we had the conference in 1990, there was this guy who had written a book using a Travis McGee character, which was totally wrong. Mm-hmm. He showed up. He had a hairy chest with all sorts of blinging jewelry hanging from him. And he actually booked F-18 slot. And he bought his boat there and he was trying to peddle his book. So a few of us took him aside and says, well, no, we don't want you to do this. And he did leave and so forth. But that was one of those things I remember from that time in terms of the boat slip.
Wow.
I know. Thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Craig, how'd you get turned on to John D. McDonald?
Well, I come from a whole family of mystery readers. My grandfather worshipped Perry Mason, read all the books, saw the TV show. Mm-hmm. My mom's big Agatha Christie fan, always loved the Hercule Poirot mysteries. And my great aunt, you know, she saw I had gone from reading Encyclopedia Brown, Sherlock Holmes to, you know, Sam Spade and Philip Marlowe. And she's, you know, I got to be 14 years old and my great aunt just takes a drag on her Pall Mall. I think you're ready for Travis McGee now, she said. And and she hands me this paperback book that has a sort of a half-naked woman on the cover, but she's turned with her back to you, so you can't see anything. And of course, I'm 14. I'm like, yes, ma'am, I guess I am ready for Travis McGee. Well, that was the Deep Blue Goodbye, the first Travis McGee novel. And, you know, she gave me that and two others, and I was hooked because, you know, although I'd read all these mysteries, they all took place in you know, New York, Los Angeles, San Francisco. These were set in Florida, and it had never occurred to me that such a sunny place could have so many shady people in it.
Yeah.
And then the environmental theme sort of spoke to me too. You know, I was going hunting with my dad or fishing or going camping with my Boy Scout troop. And it never occurred to me that there might be people who would be coming in and, you know, wiping out all these gorgeous places that I enjoyed visiting mm-hmm. and doing it because of greedy motives that, you know, weren't really for the good of all mankind. So yeah. It was a real eye opener for me to read his work.
If someone's interested, where should they start? Which title would you recommend?
Well, with Travis McGee, you should definitely start with the first one, Deep Blue Goodbye. For the non-McGee books, I would recommend Condominium, which we mentioned, which is just a masterpiece. This is a guy who had an MBA, and so he knew all about business and how heartless it could be. And he had studied building practices, so he's able to describe all the crooked politics and shaky building practices mm-hmm. and shady financing involved in building a condominium on a barrier island in Florida. And then he brings in a Category 5 hurricane. It may be the best hurricane description I've ever read. So maybe don't read it. Maybe don't read it during hurricane season. I mean, it's like reading In Cold Blood at night when you're home alone, you know. I'm reading one of his non-McGee books right now called Slam the Big Door, which Calvin tells me was McDonald's own favorite novel among his non-McGee books. It's really good. And it's set in a very vividly described place near Sarasota on a barrier island. With these characters who are very vivid to me. You know, there's a shady rancher involved in land development, and even though it's 1960, there's still that environmental theme in there. Because at one point, one of the characters says, "I figured out land development in Florida. You've got to hate trees."
Well, sadly, that is a welcome to Florida story.
Yeah. Yes, welcome to Florida.